We have these sessions every Friday night, with mostly our speaker tonight, Bhante Sujatha. Have a couple of flyers here for anyone who is new and wants to find out a little bit more. In fact, I'll give you one right now. So Bhante Sujatha is a highly respected Australian Theravada Buddhist monk and scholar, ordained in the Thai forest tradition. In 1994, he has devoted his life to studying and teaching the earliest Buddhist scriptures, bringing this ancient wisdom to modern audiences like us. Bhante Sujatha is the founder of Sutta Central, a very useful and extensive online resource of the early Buddhist texts, very user-friendly and even entertaining sometimes. Sutta Central is Bhante's dedication to making these early Buddhist teachings accessible to everyone. Beyond his scholarship, Bhante Sujatha is known for his clear, compassionate, and insightful teachings on meditation. Tonight, he will share that wisdom so we can find calm, clarity, and a deeper understanding of the Dhamma. Please welcome Bhante Sujatha Bhikkhu.
Thank you very much, Tina. Very kind. So welcome everyone here, welcome all of our folks online joining us from places all over the place, and let us begin with some chanting. We have chanting sheets. Anybody who needs the chanting sheets? Anyone need? Okay, let's go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami. Itipiso bhagava arahaṃ sammasambuddho vijja charana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi Sattha deva manusanang buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhittiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko Pachatam veditabo vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Ujupatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Nyayapatipanno bhagavato Vakasangho Samichi Patipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Yadi dam chatari purisa yugani artha purisa pungala esa bhagavato sahavaka sangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakirneyo andali karaneyo anuttaram punyaketam lokasati. Okay, very good. Okay, so time to do some meditation. Celia, have you done meditation before? Really? Tell me about it.
Yes. Where? Not here. I used to meditate with a friend.
Okay.
We used to have it in her home.
Okay, nice.
I'm not sure whether you know Arunee De Silva.
Arunee De Silva?
Yes.
I know Arunee De Silva. Well, I know Arunee. I don't know if it's the same one.
From Burunga? She used to live in Burunga.
Maybe,
yeah.
Yes.
Maybe. She's
Sri Lankan. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, anyway.
Yeah, so yes, that was ages ago.
Ah.
And yes, now I'm here, back here.
Okay, very good. So normally we do some mindfulness of breathing meditation. Unless anybody has any strong objections, would you like to do something else for this week? Do some mindfulness breathing? What do you think? It's good? All right. All right, so when we enter upon the practice of meditation, we are entering upon a spiritual space, a spiritual path that has been trodden by many feet. We're not doing the latest and greatest thing. We're not innovating. And we're not making any kind of new discoveries, at least as far as human culture is concerned, but we are, of course, making new discoveries as far as we personally are concerned. So one of the keys to understanding meditation is that there's something which is very universal to humanity and which gives us a possibility for a shared pathway. And this is very important because it means that we can talk about it. And there are some who believe that a spiritual path is something that we can lay out and define, and all we have to do is to be subservient to that and to submit to that, and then we'll be fine. And there are others who believe that truth is a trackless land and that there's no way of communicating it. I think both of those are kind of extreme positions. I think that there are ways that we can talk about meditation, about the path that's going to be helpful and guide us. But at the same time, the most important thing is that we can find out that truth for ourselves. Because the reality is that when I teach meditation, I teach one thing, and then you all hear a whole bunch of different things. It's hilarious. You're going to come and go away. Everyone's going to have a completely different kind of meditation. And if by some strange chance I happen to talk about something that's relevant for you, you'll be like, wow, Bhante must be reading my mind. That's incredible. But that's not incredible. It's just a coincidence. And the fact is that our minds kind of work in similar ways, but the actual details of what's going on in our minds are all very different. So it's difficult to It's difficult to sort of to know exactly what's going on in someone's mind. So that's why, you know, anybody who's been hanging around with me or practicing going to my retreats for a while would know that I'm not one of those teachers who'll go around telling students, oh, you've got this attainment, you've got that attainment, you've got this jhana, you've got that jhana. I've like literally never said that to anyone in my life. And that's not what it's about. It's not about knowing that you have this attainment or that attainment or anything like that. And it's not about measuring yourself by some external path. It's about learning how to let go. So if we can learn how to let go, then we are moving forward. So never think that somehow you can't do it. Never think that you're not adequate. Never think that you're not good enough. The Buddha was not concerned with where you are in the path so much as he was concerned with what direction that you're moving. We all just are where we are, it's all right. But where are our feet leading us? What direction are we treading? We know from the Buddha's teachings, and that I try to convey to you as best I can, we know generally how that path should go. But for each one of you, maybe your next step will be onto a thorn. Could be. No? So someone in the front row is in denial of this. It's never going to happen, which probably means it is going to happen. Sorry about the bad news. Maybe the next step will be into a garden of beautiful flowers, and you'll be like, oh, that's much better, yeah? But turns out they're all opium poppies. So you'll be like Dorothy on the yellow brick road and fall asleep in the haze. So anyway, this is the way that the path goes. So your path is your own, and it's unexpected and it's strange. So don't be too caught up in it has to be like this, it has to be like that. We have enough guidance to be able to orientate ourselves, but then we also have to be alive to what is actually presenting itself to us. Now, when we do mindfulness of breathing meditation, the course of mindfulness of breathing meditation is very straightforward. When we begin, our breath is more ragged, more coarse, more changeable, because our mind and our body are all over the place. Energies are out of balance. And the longer that we go in the meditation, the more our mind and body settle down. And as our mind and body settle down, our breath settles down. And these things work in a virtuous cycle. So the longer we go with breath meditation, the more peaceful we become. So that part of breath meditation is fairly straightforward, and that encompasses really the first four steps of mindfulness of breathing. I'm not going to go into all the different steps in detail, but there's 16 steps, and this more or less the first four in summary is about meditating as the breath becomes more peaceful. And that bit is straightforward, and it's something that you can experience pretty much in any meditation, at least to some degree. If you sit in meditation for 20 minutes or so, then you'll feel your breath becoming more peaceful. Okay. And if that's all you've ever experienced in meditation, you'll be thinking, okay, meditation's fairly straightforward. But that's just the beginning. And that's just where things start to get interesting. Because your breath is not just air. And this is one of the levels of wisdom that starts to unfold as you continue in your meditation. Breath is more than just air. And once your breath has become very tranquil, the breath will start to reveal itself. And the Buddha talked about bhiti parisamvedi, experiencing the breath while experiencing joy and rapture, breathing while experiencing pleasure and happiness. And so what exactly does this mean? How does something as ordinary and prosaic as the breath become transformed into joy or into rapture? And this, again, is only the start. And the breath reveals itself at deeper and deeper layers so that we find that journey into the breath becomes not more predictable as we go deeper, but less predictable as we go deeper, more surprising and more revelatory, until we realize that the breath, which we took for granted our whole life, is actually extremely profound and very subtle. So let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation and see what our breath has to teach us. Sitting quietly. Give yourself a few minutes to let your body settle back into your posture. Experiencing nothing but peace, relaxation. With your back straight and your head tilted slightly forward. And now bringing attention to the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. So coming near to the end of the meditation. Bring your mind back into your senses. And taking a minute to recollect back over the course of the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself what just happened. How did your mind change? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. So let's take a break for a few minutes, grab a cup of tea. And I'll see you back here for some Dhamma talk. Do I have any pets? No, I don't. Why? Can monastics keep pets? I was asking the hard questions today. Yes, monastics can keep pets, and in fact it's very common. Most monasteries actually tend to be like strays and stuff get dumped in them all the time. Yeah, so they have a bit of both. Yeah, they get food and love sometimes. So yes, sometimes they'll just wander in, but they also get dumped there. Yeah, it happens a lot. In fact, I've even done that before. Yeah, I've done that before. I was staying in a hut by myself in a teak forest in northern Thailand, in Nan, and this kitten adopted me. Oh my God, it was so cute. I'm like, oh my God, you are so cute. This is ridiculous. And it would come and cuddle when I'm just sitting there, and then I'd be doing like walking meditation, and then it'd be just kind of coming up next to walking meditation beside me, and then often sometimes underneath my feet as well, and it's like so cute. But I'm like, dude, I'm vegetarian for a start, so I don't have a lot of food for you, and I'm also allergic to cats. So it's not going to be a long-term situation. And anyway, I talked to the owner of the kuti, and they said, oh, look, there's a temple where they have a lot of cats and so on. So he took it off to the temple. So, yes, unfortunately. We never had pets when I was growing up, which I think was my mum didn't want to have pets. My dad likes having pets. He grew up with pets and he had dogs after my parents split. So I think that's probably also part of the conditioning that we never had them when we were growing up. In Perth? You know Perth?
It's my favorite place.
Perth is your favorite place. I'm so sorry. But I'm sure you'll have other life experiences as things go on. You'll find more wonderful places. No, I'm only kidding. That's good. You like Perth. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, of course. I'm allowed to because I was from there. So, all right. So, okay, let's do some Dhamma talk. So, I got asked to talk a little bit about the. No, Dark Week is next week. Dark Week is on the. Oh, let me announce that. So the Dark Week is on the week following the first Tuesday. Yeah, that's right. It almost was. So next week is Dark Week. For those of you who don't know what Dark Week is, then you may have noticed, but there is a lot of terrible things happening in the world all the time. And I believe that it's important from a spiritual perspective to give some kind of moral and ethical guidance and perspective on the many terrible things that are happening. But at the same time, also nobody wants to hear about all that stuff all the time, and we get bombarded with too much stuff on social media and so on and so forth. So I was thinking about this for a while and thinking about how do you like put boundaries around it so you can talk about things but also limit it and keep it within certain boundaries. So then I had this idea to do Dark Week, so I'll talk about dark topics once a month. So that's on the week following the first Tuesday of the month. And in previous Dark Weeks, first one I talked about Jeffrey Epstein, and second one I talked about war. And for this one, I'm going to be talking about something that's even darker. In fact, everybody's thinking of all these dark topics. And yes, these are indeed dark topics. And yes, I'll probably do a Dark Week on these topics in the future. But this particular week is going to be talking about something which is very dark. In fact, it's something about which you will think, how much darker could it be? And the answer will be none. None more dark. That one's for all the Spinal Tap fans out there. But anyway, moving along. No Spinal Tap fans, really. Seriously. I'm so alone. Next week. Yeah, it'll be something about that which is so dark that nothing more can be darker. And no, I know what you're thinking, okay? Thank you, Venerable Prasanna, got it. Thank you. Thank you for seeing me, Venerable. Scott, thank you also. Thank you for seeing me, okay? so something about that which there is nothing more dark. And no, I know what you're all thinking, okay? It's not about Vegemite, okay? Don't make it weird. You're going to have a Zen retreat tomorrow. I'll have a great retreat.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry to leave so
No problems. Okay, so that will be next week. This week, I was asked to talk a little bit about how the Buddhist scriptures came to be and how they were memorized, and I think this is an interesting topic. And I'm going to use it as a springboard for talking about education in Buddhism more generally, and about how we listen to things and how we learn things. Okay, so these days, when we want to learn things, we generally speaking have most people turn to technology. Right? You want to learn things, oh, we're going to put things in the classroom, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to introduce all this technology and so on and so forth. But it does seem to me, I don't know about you, it seems to me that we are very quick to adapt all of these things, but without actually knowing whether they do any good. And the longer that we go on, the more we seem to realize that actually most of these methods don't actually help, or if they do help, they only help in very specific circumstances. A good example being PowerPoints. Right, so PowerPoints became like this dominant thing. If you're going to be speaking, you're going to be using a PowerPoint and blah, blah, blah. But all of the studies show that PowerPoints actually reduce retention of information. basically because you are, and you can see it. Like I remember being at a conference, Buddhist conference in like 2006 or something like that, and some speakers would use PowerPoints, and those speakers were talking to the screen, and other speakers were not using PowerPoints, and they were talking to the audience. And there's a huge difference. Obviously, there's a role for it. If you're going to be presenting a graph or something like that, then there's a role for, you know, a diagram or an illustration, then there's a role for it. But just to think I'm going to summarize my thing and put it up there, it doesn't actually work. It ends up dividing people's attention so that you're not really paying attention to anything. So that's just one kind of technology. And of course, there are a gazillion types of other technologies. And these days we use a lot of AI and so on, and people rolling out AI for all of these things. And it turns out, incidentally, that like some of the firms investigating how people are using AI, like some of these firms actually pay people to use AI. So like you're expected to use AI in your work, even though it costs a lot of money. And it turns out that what they're doing is converting all their PDFs into PowerPoints, so that you can do whatever. Anyway, so I feel like we adopt a lot of these technologies, but without really having any evidence to back up the fact that they are successful. Now, obviously, some technologies are useful for some things. We're using technologies as right now. But I do feel like we should be more reflective and more circumspect about them, and to be using technologies no more than is necessary, rather than falling back on them as a default. Now, that doesn't mean that things, that we can't improve our education and communication skills. Actually, in Buddhism, those things have been there from the beginning. And it seems to me a shame that in Buddhism we are so quick to jump on the bandwagon of doing something in a new way, while at the same time neglecting to learn from how the Buddha actually did things. And because the Buddha himself gave us so many great examples of actually how to do teaching. And I've been studying this for so long, I also am aware of how often I fail to do what the Buddha did. I'm working on it, trying to do better. Okay, but there are patterns, and there are methods that the Buddha deployed to make his teaching engaging, so that people would be able to memorize it. And I'm just going to run through a couple of brief ones. A very obvious one is the use of similes. And if we look in the Buddha's discourses, very commonly we find ABA is structure. The Buddha will give a teaching. He would say, and now my mind's going blank because I'm not the Buddha. Obviously, I need another coffee. No, I've had enough coffee, Sujata. No. we give a simile. There are these four kinds of meditators who are like four kinds of thoroughbred horses, something like that. So you give the simile, right? There's a thoroughbred horse who you just have to give one word to, and then they leap out of the gate. And then there's another one who you have to train and train and train before they can run, and so on and so forth. So the Buddha would give these similes. And so the Buddha would always give the teaching, and then he'll give the simile, and then he will repeat the teaching again. It's the ABA structure. And you find this ABA structure all through the suttas. You also find the structure of giving the summary and then explaining the points and then repeating the summary at the end. This is the basic format of the half an hour news format, right? At the beginning, you give the headlines, then you have like four or five main stories, you give those stories, and then you repeat it at the end. And that's used in the suttas all the time, like constantly. There are hundreds and hundreds of instances where the Buddha taught like that. And so this is also giving us another example of using reinforcing learning. So we've already learned a couple of things about how the Buddha used ABA structure, using similes to illustrate his ideas. And we've also mentioned about using reinforcement. So I'm now consciously trying to use these techniques as I'm doing it, right? And so I'm using reinforcement as I'm teaching because I'm remembering that's how the Buddha used to do it. Okay, so reinforcement is another one. but another method that the Buddha always used, or commonly used, was about questioning. Right? Very common phrase you find in the suttas, "Tangkin Manyata." What do you think? Why? Because otherwise people can just sit there and get bored and fall asleep. You might imagine, okay? You might think, here's me. I was alive in the time of the Buddha. I could get to go and hear the Buddha giving a Dhamma talk, okay? That would be the most incredible thing ever. And I would go there and be like, wow, this is amazing. And I'd never fall asleep or get bored or get distracted. But I've got some news for you. You would get bored and you would get distracted. And sometimes you'd be like, no, I don't think I've got to see the Buddha giving a Dhamma talk. You know, it's a bit raining outside. I think I'll stay at home, you know. It's just how people are, yeah. It's just how people are. So he would engage with people and try to bring the Dhamma out. Okay, so this is another method that the Buddha used. So far we've looked at the ABA method. We've looked at the method of summary and lists and repeating the summary. We looked at the method of engagement and question and counter question, and so on. And so there are many other methods that we could talk about. Another one is the Buddha's. First, when the Buddha was speaking to somebody, especially somebody that he didn't know, he would always begin by asking them something and finding some point in common. He used this all the time. And when you recognize this pattern, you can see this countless times in the suttas. Find some point in common that he has with that person, and then that's the beginning of a conversation. Now, even if the person was like very aggressive or critical of the Buddha, he would find that one point in common and then would go on. Yeah. So this is another method. So far we looked at four methods: ABA structure with an illustration, the use of a lists with summaries and recapitulations. We looked at the counter questioning method, and we've looked at the method of finding points in common. All right. So these are all rhetorical techniques that the Buddha used. Now, that's from the teacher's side, but from the student's side, he also had advice in how to listen to Dhamma and how to understand things. And again, I'm just going to list at random a few of the things that the Buddha said. So first thing is that he said, if you are listening, okay, randhagavesi uparambhacitta, which means uparambha. Anyone? No. Almost the opposite. Randhagavesi uparambhacitta means with a fault-finding mind. Yes. If you listen with a fault-finding mind, always looking, always cynical, always trying to find something wrong, then you're never going to understand the Dhamma, right? This is also important, right? So we don't listen with an overly credulous mind. We don't just take everything for granted. We use inquiry and so on, but we're also not overly cynical and skeptical. These are two extreme points of view, right? So this is one thing. If we have overly fault-finding mind, then we're never going to understand the Dhamma. Okay, so one of the things which the Buddha emphasize, okay, so when first thing is that in a teaching environment that it should be set up in a proper way. So for example, when the Buddha was going for alms round, and sometimes people would come up to him and ask questions, and this happens to me on alms round in Harris Park as well, people come up and ask questions and so on, and the Buddha would say, well, this is not the right time, and now I'm on alms round. And so this is there are wrong times to be asking about Dhamma. Now, the Buddha wouldn't make a hard and fast rule about that. Sometimes people would insist, and then he'd say, okay, and he would talk to them about it, but it's not ideal. So you want to have a time and a place for teaching, just as we do for meditation. And when I talk about setting up your meditation practice, I always emphasize you need a time and a place to meditate. The same thing for teaching. Here we are. We have a place. It's nice. It's a nice place. It could be better. I tell you, we could be living in a open-air wooden sala on a warm spring day in the foothills of the Himalayan mountains, right? And we could be gathered there for listening to Dhamma with the full moon outside. And if we were there, there would be a magic in the air that would uplift us and make us think, oh, there's something really beautiful about that, yeah? And that was honestly, that was my experience, not quite like that, but certainly like staying in forest monasteries, that when the Dhamma talk was happening, it was a special occasion. And actually, we were just walking down a track to go to the hall outside, you know, but it felt like something special because everyone was gathering together. You would do some simple rituals, some bowing and chanting, and there was a sense that you're creating a sacred space within which the Dhamma was spoken. So this is one important thing, and this is one reason why you know, I always feel like with speaking online and talking online, that it's always, you know, it's always somehow compromised. And I know that for, you know, for the folks who are listening online, that many times that you don't have other options. So, you know, we do the best that we can. But it's really nice if we can meet in person. So anyway, I'm just saying for folks online, if you're ever in Australia, hopefully you'll be in Australia sometime, or if you can come along or whatever. But yeah. Anyway, or maybe you can set up your own place. Megan, you should be setting up. Have you set up your own Dhamma classes in? Not yet? Still working on it. Okay. So having a space. So even if you can't, you know, go to a temple or something like that, then to try to do that, if you're at home, you know, you try to do that. You sit, you know, set up yourself properly. You know, you sit and you pay attention. You're not like doing the dishes while you're listening to the Dhamma talk or whatever. And I really do think that it's important to have that sense where when you're paying attention to Dhamma, then it's your full attention. So this is one of the first things when the Buddha was giving a teaching, he would say, now everyone pay attention, okay? And this was like, this is a standard part of opening a discourse. Yeah, everybody sit down. Okay, everyone sit down, shut up, pay attention, listen, okay? And if we're not, then this is a real, you're not really hearing things. And the Buddha's assemblies were regarded as being distinguished by the silence and attentiveness of the audience, and that you wouldn't even hear, you know, people like coughing or whispering to each other or anything like that, but there would just be silence and attention at the Buddha's talks. So this is one thing, is the quality of attention. And this is something that I also teach to students. If you know, how are we going to be using Dhamma to help us in the classroom? So the number one thing that I would say is about paying attention. So if we can learn to be mindful and paying attention, right? So you have to do carrot and stick, right? So you have to be like, if you can pay attention fully in class, that means you don't have to do your homework. Right? Might have lost a few people there. Or at least it makes it a lot easier, right? And a lot easier to revise things. But then the other thing is not just paying full attention when you're doing it, right? The Buddha also would say that you should pay full attention. You should bend your ear, right? It's really interesting, right? So sotang odahaka, you should turn your ear towards it. Bend your ear towards it. So again, this is very different from like how people will like put on a Dhamma talk in the background and they're driving their car or something like that. You're not bending your ear towards it. You're not treating it as something which is really valuable and precious and which deserves your full attention. But I'm promising you that to pay full attention to the Dhamma is where you will get your wisdom from, not just putting it in the background and having it as a hum or something like that. So bending your ear towards it, then inquiring into it. This also is very important. While you're listening, then also there needs to be a process of reflection, okay? So it's not just the Buddha used these techniques of repetition, right? ABA structures, items with summaries and recapitulations. So the Buddha used these techniques, but this is also the technique that you need to use when listening. So when you listen to it, you remind yourself, what has this Dhamma talk been about so far? What are the things that Bhante's talked about? We talked about technology and education. We talked about about four different ways that the Buddha said used for teaching techniques. We talked about the establishment of a place for teaching and so on. So if you can reflect like that during the talk, okay, every so often, then you will retain the talk. You'll walk away from the talk and somebody will say to you, what did Bhante talk about? Now, normally, if I do that and say, I say, what's the talk like? They say, oh, it's good. I say, what's it about? Oh, there's like a few different things. But you should be able to actually write a list of all of the things that were talked about. You should be able to say, we talked about this and then this and then this and then this, if you're really paying attention. When you do that, you pay, you reflect and inquire, then that also gives you a few things. Sometimes when you're listening, there's things that you don't understand. And often what happens, if there's something you don't understand, then you kind of switch off. You kind of start to drift and you think, oh, you've lost me now, right? So if you can reflect, you make a note of that. You say, hang on, I didn't understand that. Okay, I'll find out about that later. Yeah? You make that note, you say, okay, then move on to the next thing, right? So the fact that you don't understand something doesn't mean you can't understand the talk as a whole. You make a note, you'll find out about it later, then you move on. So so to be there, to pay attention, to lend an ear, to reflect on those teachings, to memorize the teachings, right, and to bear them in mind after you've got up. Right, so we can all do this to some extent. Like when you're going home from after the talk, remind yourself, what was this talk about? Ask yourself, what was like four or five main takeaway points from the talk? And only actually takes a few seconds. You say, oh, we talked about this, we talked about that, we talked about that. Okay, and if you do that a couple of times, you'd be really surprised at how much it aids your retention. That's that power of repetition. That you can go from coming away from the talk and you'll be thinking, oh, you know, we talked about this and that. And you say, well, we come away from the talk and we talked about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And these are the main points in the talk. And it really can help. And it's a really good method for education as well. So you'd be surprised at the amount that you can retain by using some active reflection in what you're doing in education. And so these are techniques which were taught by the Buddha. So he didn't just exemplify them through his teaching, but he actually gave specific teachings about doing this many times. There's many different suttas that talk about this. So setting up the right attitude of wanting to learn, right? Not having an overly critical mind space, having the right time and place to talk, having that paying attention, lending an ear, reflecting on what you've heard and memorizing it and bearing it in mind. Afterwards, even repeating it and going over it again, rehearsing it, and making notes or making points of questioning where you can get something clarified at a later point. So these are all details of how to listen to Dhamma that the Buddha taught. And, of course, they're not just useful for listening to Dhamma, they're useful for learning anything, right? So if you can do this, it's really kind of astonishing. So I'll just tell you kind of one story that happened to me. I really remember this story because I really surprised myself. I was at a Dhamma event in India, in Bodh Gaya. And we were chanting the Pali Tripitaka. So this was organized by Venerable Kiribhat Gordon Yanananda and Wanmo Dixie and others from the Buddha Light Foundation. Anyway, many years ago. So we're going there chanting in Pali and for many days. And so I had trained myself to have quite a good memory from when I was a monk and memorized different scriptures and so on. So we're in India, we're chanting, and they're putting the Pali texts are on the screen, right? So you have like a screen so people can chant along. And then, of course, being India, the power goes out. And one of the organizers came to me afterwards. He said, I noticed that when the power went out, all the monks stopped chanting except you. You were the only one who kept going. I said, yeah. I will know it, so don't need the screen. So anyway, with one time there was this Thai teacher there. He was giving a talk, and there was no one to translate. So they said, is there anyone who speaks Thai? So I said, I can speak Thai. So they said, can you translate? I said, sure. Okay, fine. So this monk I never met before starts talking. I'm like, oh, phew, thank God, he speaks Central Thai. It's not like some dialect or something like that. Fine. I'm like, okay, good. He's like an educated monk. He's using like Pali terms and stuff like that. So that makes it hard for Thai people to understand it, but it makes it easy for me to understand it. So I'm like, great. And so I was translating. And as we're going on, he's getting more confident and more into it. And so his translation segments are getting longer and longer. And then he starts telling this story and went on for like 20 minutes or something. And luckily I knew the story, right? Because he's telling like stories from the whatever Jatakas or something like that. And so, and I know what he's saying, right? So I remember I'm like, and he just keeps on going. Somebody came up to me with some a pad of paper and says, do you want to take some notes? I'm like, no, I'm okay. So just listening and then just making notes and revising it every few minutes. Every 5 minutes I go back and say, we talked about this. Okay, go on, talk about this. And then I just translated it. It's like 20 minutes just off the top of my head. Yeah. And I was like really surprised. I didn't know I could do that. But in that time, at that moment, I was quite confident. Because my mind had that clarity that I could actually know what I was doing. So one of the questions then that Alex asked was about like how this process of memorization happens, right? In one way, we can think of technology as being an assault on memory. And like there's a whole kind of dialogue there about how that works, right? But I mean, you can there's horror stories coming out of schools today where they'll have a class discussion and then the teacher will ask the one of the students to say, you know, can you summarize what we just discussed, and they'll say okay, and then they'll ask ChatGPT, what did we just discuss? And they got no capability of actually remembering what they've talked about. So, but we can think about that like in terms of like even like if you go a long way back, even in terms of writing, right? So these days we get used to the idea that we're writing down our scriptures, right? And that's been going on for more than 2,000 or about 2,000 years, been writing down scriptures. But I can imagine that at the time there would have been a lot of cranky old monks who'd be like, writing down the scriptures? No way, you have to memorize it. If you write it down, you'll just put it in a box and forget about it. Nobody's going to be reading them. I probably would have been one of those cranky monks. I would have been there at that time. I'd be like, what are you people doing? No, you have to memorize it. Yeah. And the Sangha only resorted to that when because it was under very hard conditions. There'd been like war, there'd been famine, and they found that there was only like one monk who'd memorized one particular scripture. And so they were scared that they were going to lose these texts. So then they resorted to writing them down, but only out of really desperation. That's the story that's preserved in Sri Lanka for the writing down of the Tripitaka. And we know that scriptures were written down around that same time throughout India. So, you know, at each place they would have had their own story about it. So we became a manuscript tradition. So you can imagine that going from an oral tradition to a manuscript tradition, it's interesting how that would happen. Does that mean that the one who had memorized it would then sit down and write it from memory? Maybe, right? Maybe. Or would it mean that one would recite and one would write? Yeah, maybe. Probably a combination of different things. So anyway, we became a scriptural tradition, but we've never been entirely a scriptural tradition because we always keep the oral tradition alive. And within the Buddhist tradition, we still recite our sacred words like we did today, right? We actually recited words. The chants we did today in Pali are found in the Tripitaka. So we were actually keeping, in a very literal sense, we were reciting today the same words that were recited by the Sangha at the First Council. Right? Those very same words were recited at the First Council immediately after the Buddha passed away. They're included in the Tripitaka. And so many of you have probably been coming along to these sessions for a long time and maybe haven't quite memorized them all yet, right? So it still takes a while to get them to memorize them. That's okay, because we haven't been acculturated to do that. We haven't been trained to memorize it. We haven't learned how to do that. I learned how to do that, and it's not a kind of a secret or anything. There's no There's no mystery to it. I learned how to do it because I was a musician, and I learned countless songs. I was not just a musician. I was a fan of Bob Dylan, so I was learning, like, you know, Desolation Row and Visions of Johanna and all of these very, very long songs. And so after a while, you train yourself to be able to memorize the large amounts of text. So when we exercise the faculty of memory, then it becomes something that we can rely on and that we know. And so not only would be an individual, so this was, I've been talking about like the individual effort at listening and being able to reflect, but it's also about the culture. It's about being surrounded by people where this is an expectation, where we are supporting each other. They would recite together. So when you recite together, then you always be able to know, you know, if you've forgotten something or you're mispronouncing something or something like that, then you can always fix it. But there's even a deeper layer to all of this. So far I've been talking about being able to memorize the scripture, to reflect on it and so on. But there's something which is obviously far more important than any of those, which is the meaning of the scripture, which is how it relates to your own experience. If you learn to read Buddhist scripture contemplatively, then you begin to understand that these are not just scriptures to be read, but they are also to be experienced. They are in a very literal sense meditation guides. So a very good example of that is the Anapanasati Sutta. So we just did some guided meditation on mindfulness of breathing. And I always begin, as I always do, saying mindfully one breathes in, mindfully one breathes out. It's a quote from the sutta, so sato va asasati, sato pasasati, the way that the Buddha would introduce this meditation. But then throughout the whole of the 16 steps, digham va asasanto, digham asasami tisikati, digham va pasasanto, digham pasasami tisikati, rasam va asasanto, rasasisami tisikati. So each time, each phrase takes one breath. Each phrase of those 16 steps takes one breath when you're reciting. That's something you're never going to see if you're just reading it. Right? The recitation is already connecting you to the rhythm of your breath. And so you're experiencing that process of meditation through that and reflecting on yourself. The same thing if you're reciting something like, say, the contemplation of the khandhas, yeah? Rupang nichang va, anichang va, di nichang va, anichang bhante, nichang va. And you can recite these things. Is form permanent or impermanent? And these things are repeated again and again through the suttas. And when you read them and you're like, oh, yeah, I know that. Yeah, form's impermanent, fine. What's next? Feeling's impermanent. Yeah, I know that. Okay, that's fine. And so it becomes something that you almost skip over or dismiss because you've heard these things so many times before. But when you're reciting it, it becomes an opportunity for reflection. And so you're reciting Rupang wa anichang wa anichang wa di. And so you're reflecting on the impermanence of your body as you're doing it. Vedana nichangva anichangva, is my feeling permanent or impermanent? And so you're watching the impermanence of your feelings as you are doing the recitation. So this also is how you're internalizing and reflecting on the teaching, but is also how you are memorizing the teaching, because they matter. They have a meaning. It's not just empty words. And when those things mean something to you, that's when you really don't forget them. Yeah, that's when it will go right into your heart and it will stay there for your whole life. So this is at a deep level how those teachings, because your efforts to memorize and learn and study the Dhamma is not just because you want to master an intellectual topic, but it's because you believe that these things are the key to unlocking freedom from suffering. And so that's why we put all of that effort into these things. Now, during the Buddha's lifetime, the Buddha would give these teachings, and then the normal thing would be that the Buddha would give, mostly the Buddha gave fairly short teachings, okay? If we look at the suttas, the Buddha gave most of the teachings probably like between 10 to 20 minutes, not more than that, most of the time. Longer ones, Longer teachings are mostly either compilations of shorter teachings or dialogues. Right? But there's very few discourses where the Buddha would actually just sit down and then talk for an hour. Or very few. Brahmajala Sutta would be one, and there are a few others like that. But if you look, there's actually very few. So shorter segments, obviously easier to memorize. Yeah. Rather than giving like a whole expansive curriculum, the Buddha was giving comprehensible bite-sized pieces of Dhamma at each point. And the individuals who are present at those teachings would then memorize those particular teachings, go away, reflect on it, recall it. Remember that there were not so many distractions in those days, right? You went to a Dhamma talk. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go home and watch telly or scroll Facebook or something. You go home and there's like literally nothing except for a kuti with nothing in it and maybe a candle if you're feeling luxurious. And so you don't have like books and you don't have screens and you don't have people to talk to or anything like that. So you go home and you reflect on what that teaching was. You reflect it, try to memorize it, and then you sit in meditation. And the sitting in meditation is what empowers all of these things. I was talking with my friend Venerable Nanali about this one time, and he was saying that he was asked by one of the Buddhist professors, how do you write so many articles? And if you've followed Nanali's career, he's written ridiculous numbers of articles and books and all of these kinds of things. And he said, this professor asked him, how come you're so productive? He said, meditation. His professor's like, what do you mean? He had no comprehension of how you can do that. And Analia just laughed. He said, I've got no special methods for doing these things. Like every time I write an article, I don't have like a bibliography that I can cut and paste or anything like that. I just write the whole bibliography by hand every time. And he's got like no special tricks for pumping out articles at a rapid pace. But his special trick is that he'll take a few days off to do a retreat every week. And so he'll just meditate. And then when he's finished with his retreat, he'll then spend a few days writing. But by the time he comes to write, he's very clear about what he wants to do. And he will just set about and then we'll just do it. And so that's his secret. So these days we're so concerned with having these like tricks and techniques and technologies and so on and so forth. But actually, that's not really what makes a difference. What makes a difference is having the clarity of mind and the purpose to be able to achieve what you really want to achieve. So these things were all memorized at different times and different places. Very often, different individuals would only know a very small amount. Like you might only just hear the Buddha giving one teaching. Right? If you were living in some remote village or something like that. I mean, normally people would know more than that, right? It would have been considered normal, certainly within the Sangha, to memorize some of the key discourses like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and Atthalakkhana Sutta and so on. So there would be some which were considered to be universal. But a lot of the times people would only know one sutta or a few suttas or something like that. And then when they had monasteries, they would start to get together and they would repeat them. So you would have communities where there may be a teacher who specialized in one particular kind of scripture, and then they would teach that to their students. And there's a few stories of how this sort of came to be in the commentaries and things like that. So this was organized originally in terms of, or not necessarily organized, but it was classified originally in terms of what they call the nine angas. So in Buddhism, this is a kind of a classification, the suttas, verses, analyses, and so on. So nine categories. That was around in the Buddha's day. But after the Buddha passed away, the Sangha got together at what we call the first council. And this was organized by some of the senior monks following the Buddha's passing away. And then they got together in Rajagaha for the rains retreat. They spent the first month of the rains retreat cleaning the monastery. Underappreciated fact here, right? They said, oh, these monasteries have been neglected. Nobody's been here for a while. We're going to spend a month fixing the roofs and repairing the windows and cleaning the toilets. So that's what all the arahants were doing for 1 month, right? Underappreciated detail. Then then when that was ready, then they got together and they recited. And the recitation is described, the manner of doing that is described in our Vinaya text, specifically in the first council text, the Khandaka number 21. And they had one main monk who was leading, and unfortunately it was monks. There weren't nuns present at this, which actually is contrary to the Buddha's instructions. I mean, this is a kind of a detail of history. When the Buddha talked about how the community was to preserve his scriptures, he always said it should be preserved by bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen. This is the fourfold sangha who will be preserving the canon. But when it was done afterwards, it was the records say it was preserved by the community of monks for whatever reason. Anyway, so the Upali was in charge of the Vinaya, Ananda was in charge of the suttas, and they were questioned, and where did this happen, who was present, and so on, and then they recounted those texts. Now, obviously, that description we have of the first council is formalized. It obviously would have been probably more complicated and messier than we have mentioned, but that's the description as has been passed down. So at these events, when a large group of monks is present and reciting together, then this is a way of checking and standardizing things. And so all of those different teachings where everyone had a little bit was now brought together and it was now organized. So the Buddhist scriptures as we have today are organized. We have the long discourses, middle discourses, connected discourses, and numerical discourses. And so these are ways of being able to group similar or related discourses together, and these would have been taught in different monasteries. So there'd be one monastery where they'd specialize in the Majjhima Nikaya, another one they specialized in the Digha Nikaya, and then the students would learn certain discourses, and when they'd mastered that, they'd learn more. If they mastered the whole of that collection, then they'd go to another monastery with another teacher, and then they would learn that one as well. So some would then master the whole thing. And so we know that this happened for a long time in Buddhism because there are inscriptions that record that there are bhikkhus and also bhikkhunis who had memorized the whole Tripitaka or who had memorized different parts of the Tripitaka. And these are recorded in inscriptions on stupas and Buddha images and things like that. So that tradition kept on going for quite a long time. So this is how the Buddhist tradition organized and kept this together. It's an astonishing achievement, truly. There's nothing like it in history. If we look back at ancient history, like the different ways in which scriptures were accumulated, even in ancient India, there's really nothing like it. Like the Hindu scriptures are very impressive, but the Hindu scriptures were accumulated over thousands of years, many different things, many different people contributing to them over a long period of time. It's quite a different kind of thing. Same thing with the Jain scriptures. We have Jain scriptures, also very impressive collections, but they were kind of lost and fragmented and reconstructed much later. So the Buddhist tradition somehow was the first time when that whole community had got together and said, no, we need to preserve the words of this one teacher as best as we can forever. And that effort is astonishing, like truly, it really is astonishing, as from a purely historical point of view. And it speaks to the power of the Buddha's message that he inspired so many people. So this is just a few words for you today on the memorization and creation of the Buddhist scriptures, and that's a few words on how the Buddha's teachings on how to learn were reflected in the capacity of the community to memorize and maintain those teachings, and how it also empowered them to get together and to preserve those teachings. So we have them now in the present day on Sutta Central. Yay! So anyway, this is just a few words on that. Any questions or any thoughts about that? Alex, did that answer your question?
Yeah?
Sumana, yeah. So the question is, if somebody is new to Buddhism and wants to know what is a discourse, then I would say it's a teaching by the Buddha or his disciples on a particular occasion. Yeah, And if they want to ask more about it, you'd say, well, often it's a dialogue, so it's a conversation, or it may be just a teaching that the Buddha was giving to his community. Does that make sense? Do you think it would work? Yeah. But that's the main thing, is that it's like on a particular occasion, like they always begin with, you know, Ekang Samayang, at one time the Buddha's staying at such and such. So it's not like a sort of collected thing. It's like a particular specific thing. Yeah. Nina won that one. Okay, I'll get back to you in a second. Nina, yeah.
You said that earlier you said the human mind works in similar ways. People's minds work in similar ways.
Right, right.
The details might be different.
Right.
But is it likely that actually, especially in the context of the this oral traditions and then the oral traditions
right.
into scripture traditions, that there were people who actually didn't participate in that, in the way that that was conveyed.
Were there people, so just repeat for online, but were there people who didn't participate in that conveyance of that scripture? Yes, for sure, definitely.
Yeah, but not because they weren't in the right place at the right time, but they just think their minds actually don't work.
That's right, yeah. So the scriptures even talk about that there are some monks who couldn't even memorize a single four-line verse, and they tried for years and years and years and couldn't even get it, you know. But even those were able to understand the Dhamma. So the ability to memorize and analyze a scripture was specifically a quality that Venerable Ananda excelled in. And others would, I mean, people would know some teachings, right, but they weren't necessarily part of that as such, yeah. So there's always different specializations within the Sangha. Yeah.
That contradicts what you said in the beginning. Minds
works
in a similar way.
Well, I mean, so Nina's pointing out a contradiction in what I'm saying. So this is an example of when I talked about listening with a fault-finding mind, always listening to only kidding. So, when I was saying people's minds work in a similar way, I was referring to what we sometimes call the citta niyama, which is the laws or the descriptions about how mental processes work. So like contact and feeling and attention and the relationships between them and so on. Yeah. Are we okay?
Yeah.
We're good? Okay. Excellent. Okay, any other outs? Let me just check briefly online. Casey, thank you for that one. Okay, let me just go back up. Okay, so we've got a few comments from online. Okay, many people don't know how to do presentations with PowerPoint. That is correct. Daniel says, hello, everyone. Hello, Daniel. Diriyup says, we military people are trained to do it well. Okay, Diriyup, if you say so. Yeah, well, Commandant. Medical practices scribe sessions with AI now. I know. Yes, Carmen, we are all going to die. Daniel says, this is the format of the half-hour news format. What about DN33? Is that the format of the all-night rave? DN33 is a classic kind of compilation sutta, and in fact is like one of the examples of how the suttas were collected. I think it's by Sariputta, right, by the disciples, so put all together. So each of those individual parts of it would have been the half-hour news segment, but the collection as a whole is... I don't know about all night rave, but but yeah. Anyway, okay. So talk to. Okay. Yeah. So Scott had just had a conversation today with a friend about not remembering what was in these talks. Okay. So now Scott, no excuses. Okay. Venerable Papasana is using hashtag. because I usually say hashtag ban AI. I have that very commonly on my social media. Our Venerable Pasanda's now got hashtag ban ink. I like it. I like it. Thanks, Venerable. So Daniel, we used to use an operating system called, I think, Tails. It forgets everything. Nice. You use everything that you do on it, it forgets. Oh, that sounds excellent. Yeah. Okay, so Simran. Right. So Simran says that complementary to this sort of digital dementia, as somebody described it above, also is the overload of information from a variety of sources, which is overstimulating. I agree completely, and we don't have the cognitive capacity to assess the reliability of those different sources. And so everything tends to get flattened by the lack of context. So I think that it's really important, like if we're using social media and so on, to be really quite aggressive about like banning and blocking and keeping things out of your timeline. So if people are posting like AI content or they're posting like spam content and things, then just hit the block button right away, and there's no point in engaging with that kind of thing. Okay. So Casey says, Bhante, can you give a summary of the main points of your teaching once more to help us remember it? I say, okay, so listen, I'm just going to say that this feels like a test. Okay, so I feel like I'm on the spot right now. So I'm going to see, and those that story I gave about how great my memory was, that was a long time ago. Okay, so these days, I don't know whether I'm still able to do that, but anyway, so I began by talking a little bit about the topic we've just been mentioning here, about technology and about how our memory can be undermined through technology. I reflected on the role that that's had in Buddhist history as well, since we introduced the technology of writing. Then I looked at a few of the techniques that the Buddha talked about. The Buddha used in his teachings, specifically the ABA with simile structure, the itemized list with introduction and recapitulation. I talked about the use of interrogation techniques, and the last one was the the common ground one, yeah, thank you, the point of common ground. Then I looked at the methods of listening to teachings from the student's point of view, about finding, setting up a proper place, about paying attention, bending the ear, investigating, memorizing, reflecting, and repeating things afterwards. And then offered some reflections on how that education method then was what enabled the Buddhist community to come together and memorize and preserve the Buddhist scriptures over time. So I think that covers most of it. Oh no, and that process of reflecting and internalizing the text is also part of your spiritual development, because we're reflecting on the meaning of them as we're doing them. Oh, all right. So I think that got most of it, Casey. Nice. Okay. All right. So thanks, everybody, for your... Oh, yeah, one more question, Patrick.
Of the nine anghas,
yes.
Where should a beginner like me start?
Of the nine anghas, which should a beginner like you start? Well, a beginner should start with the suttas. So in the anghas has nine. The sutta is one of the nine. Okay, but the meaning of sutta is actually different, because the sutta is actually, today, what we call suttas is actually all of the nine. So sutta in the anghas has a more limited meaning, all right? Now, the word sutta, generally speaking, in Indian culture, means a short passage to be memorized, which would then be explained by the teacher or by the oral tradition, all right? So what the sutta means in the anghas is the short basic passages of Dhamma, things like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, right, which is giving you what is the Four Noble Truths and what is the Eightfold Path. So those are the things, if you really want to study Buddhism, then to learn those fundamental passages of Dhamma that deal with the Eightfold Path, the Five Aggregates, and so on and so forth. Yeah, but if you're talking about somebody who's interested in Buddhism or wants to start reading suttas, whatever you feel like, really, yeah, there's no wrong way, but usually starting with the Majjhima Nikaya is a good idea. Right. Anyway, okay, everybody, so thanks for your attention. Hopefully you'll come next week for Dark Week. And black is recommended, but you're not required. You can put some goth makeup on if you would like to get into the spirit of it, like wear a vampire costume, whatever. Anyway, and we, like I said, we're going to be talking about something which is so dark that there is nothing more dark. Right? This is a technique of manipulation, okay? This is how cults do it. I'm going to be sharing with you this secret information, and then everyone's like, oh, I've got some secret. Any hints? No, it doesn't do any of those things. Oh, but speaking of ism, I don't know if people realize the news today, but there was a schism in the Catholic Church this week. I don't know if anyone's following the news on that. Quite interesting to see. Yeah, that basically a group performed an ordination that was completely banned by the Pope, and the Pope immediately just kicked them all out of the Catholic Church. And yeah, it's quite interesting. And it's like if you want to come back, you've got to renounce all of these things. And if any of the priests who got kicked out want to come back, they have to write a handwritten letter of apology to the Pope himself. Kind of interesting, right? It has to be handwritten. I think the Pope doesn't want them writing AI apologies.
It could still be an AI.
It could be, yeah, but he's trying to do his best. Yeah. Anyway. And it applies to people who are married by those priests. So it has all of these kinds of repercussions, right? So if you're married by these priests who are now apostates, and by the way, the Pope is absolutely right to kick those guys out. They're all freaking Nazis. So yeah, there was absolutely the right thing to do. Anyway, moving ahead. So next week, you wanted to know what a hint, but what if it's nothing? But what if I just gave you a hint and it was nothing? Fair enough, she says. So see you next week, everybody.